everybody. I'm going to talk randomly a little bit here as we're getting started. I realized I made one of the most gravest errors of all time because I've already had like four people tell me to hurry it up because there's food back there. And I think I should not have agreed to Josh's, I offered to do this, but I'm realizing that was one of the dumbest decisions I might have ever made because everyone's like, you know, there's cupcakes back there and they're not serving the cupcakes because of this. So I've already cut some out of this trying to speed up a little bit, but thanks for staying, those of you who are willing to at least. I was supposed to start this back in January, but like everything in the world, that's when I got COVID, and so I missed that at the last minute. So when Steph and we're pretty sure Liam did as well, got it, so I'm starting a little bit late. If you remember, which you might not have at the time, because I gave kind of a precursor sermon leading into this, talking, kind of going through the Old Testament, talking about the concept of grace and mercy, and how God used that as a way to build up his people, kind of leading into what I want to talk about today, which is this period of the post-exile, where we really start to see then the concept of justice, which is really a theme more for the fall holy days, but I'm going to kind of tie it in a little bit to what we're doing here in the spring holy days. But I'm using it to talk about, well, I'm going to use the Persian Empire as a setup for it. Sorry, my first time using this, so I'm still kind of playing with it a little bit. So you might be asking yourself, why talk mainly about the Persian Empire as a way to speak about justice and really the concepts of grace and mercy and how it actually plays into the spring holy days, but it also, as I'm going to show, kind of plays in really even more so obviously to the fall holy days, but ties the two of those together. And where God used the concept of grace and mercy to build a people to lead to a time where we all look forward to in a world that doesn't exist quite yet, that really is reigned by the concept of justice. So this is, I'm going to get every one of my kids into a picture today. So this is Liam. This is the Louvre in Paris. So the French were the ones that excavated the vast majority of the Persian Empire. And so they got to keep the spoils of war. So these are two winged griffin-like Persian heads. That was a previous gate, and you can see the size here with Liam. This was 2 years ago when we were in Paris, and we'll see a few more as we go through it. So, but why look at the Persian Empire in this concept? So each year, we all study, and we've already started it, we study the Exodus, don't we? That story of Moses leading the people out. It's so predominant in the concept of the Passover and preparing us for the spring holy days, and it's that time that really looks at picturing making ourselves better. Coming out of the world. We read the story of this captive people who had been enslaved after generation when Joseph brought his family members into Egypt. And as we read about, you know, a king eventually came up or a pharaoh came up that did not remember Joseph. And so the people became slaves over generations and generations. But then they're released. Moses comes, he takes them out. They're released to go back to that land that was promised to them by God. But the story is always told under the backdrop, if you will, of those people who love God, but they're surrounded by evil empires. You know, in the case there, it's Egypt, who represents Satan and sin that they're told to come out of. And the people's need to remove themselves from that. But even once they leave, there's more. And they always have to kind of flee as they're trying to go to the Jordan, as they're trying to get to this land that was promised to them, and as a displaced people to try to create a nation that they were promised. But as is always the case, even though they leave Egypt, Egypt continues to be a hostile power to the nation of Israel and then the future nations of northern Israel and southern Judah. And other hostile powers exist. Assyria comes on the scene, Babylon, the Philistines are a constant thorn in the side. There's always these other great powers who are more powerful than the Israelites who always surround them, that pick on them, that do things to kind of make the world not a good place, if you will, right? And so spiritually, they're always told to come out of it. And as we know in the book of Ephesians, we kind of are sitting in the same boat because Satan is the God of this world who rules over it. And we're here and we're trying to come out of it, but we really look more forward to that time when we can also displace ourselves into a world that will exist full of justice, full of grace and full of mercy that will be different than the world we live in now. And we know that day is coming. And we know there's going to be a period of tribulation before it that will, you know, rile the world and destroy things in a way that if Christ does not come, it would literally destroy the entire world. So we look forward to these. But what if the story could flip? What if there was a period in the Old Testament that gives us a glimpse of what that will look like, of what's possible. A time when the people of God who will leave their captivity and go to rebuild their home, but a period where those threats that always arise by man that existed, always in the periphery, always over top of them, but instead a world power will exist that protects God's people, that it was not hostile, that cared for them, that provided a world protected by God and a world that where justice could exist. A time when the threats of God's people for doing what they were commanded, doing what God told them to do, they could rely on that higher power over all that was known, and they could fight the battle for them so they didn't necessarily have to do it. We look forward to that time, don't we? Sounds nice. It's that case of the millennial period that we look forward to in the future where that will be the case. But the Old Testament gives us a glimpse of that. It has that story carrying through, and we look at the, you know, what existed in the spring holidays of them trying to come out, but we look forward really to those fall holidays where that's the world that's going to exist, where Pharaoh's not there, where, you know, Assyrian empires and all these other empires won't be the case, but God's world will be ruled by his righteous justice. And there's a parallel to these two things, and that's kind of, you know, the point that I'm looking at here is, you know, we have the Passover story in the Old Testament leading to that age of man, the kingdoms, you know, the judges first, leading into the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, with their destruction and 70-year exile that comes when Assyria conquers the northern tribes of Israel, Babylon conquers the southern tribes of Judah, the people are exiled, and then this post-exilic period where they're able to return. And now we kind of sit in a parallel track that's running now, where Christ came and fulfilled that Passover once more. And now we live in this period of man that exists where Satan's still the ruler of the world. The overarching power is not God. And man's time has come. And there's good times, there's bad times, but we know there will be a tribulation in the future, much like the destruction that happened to those people, as we look forward then to a, you know, post-exilic period, if you will, for us in the coming millennium. So there's a symmetry that exists between these two. And we've studied this to a degree, and we've looked at God's people in the post-exilic time. You know, we've read the books of Ezra and the books of Nehemiah and some of the minor prophets that come from that time period, but there also exists during this time a metaphorical representation of Christ and his kingdom that is fulfilled by Gentiles. And I think that's very interesting. You know, people who are an overlaying protection for the people of God, who are deliverers from God, who are shepherds to God, both physically and spiritually during this time, and they provide an overarching righteous justice. So we're looking at a parallel story of what we're looking at now as we're, you know, coming in just a few weeks, obviously from Passover and the spring holy days, of what we'll look for in the future. And so I'd like you to imagine a difference, because if you haven't yet, you're going to have to watch the Ten Commandments soon. And Charlton Heston's booming voice and Yul Brynner will come back with one that rivals him. So imagine, if you will, that when Charlton Heston comes in and says, "Let my people go," in his voice that no one can quite, you know, mimic. What if Yul Brynner looks back at him and says, "Okay, that's a great idea. But can you give me a few minutes? Because I owe you a lot of back pay, because you've been slaves this whole time. So we've got to collect a lot of money and pay you back. And it's going to take some time. We've got to get some horses and some pack mules. You know, it's a long journey up to Jordan, so we're going to have to get all that stuff together. And, you know, we make sure we collect all that. And, you know, you're going to want to create a temple, so we'll need to get some building supplies at the same time. So I'll let you go, but we got to get all that together first." That story's not nearly as interesting, is it? You know, all of a sudden that movie, Cecil B. DeMille, is not going to write that story. But what if that story is the story? And that's what we're kind of looking at here, you know, when Moses does that. So I think that if God gives us a story in the Old Testament that is represents the future millennium and a period, but he uses a Gentile king and a Gentile empire that he founds to represent both Christ and his kingdom, and it's an empire that is poorly understood and studied in the modern world, mainly because the good guys to us in this time period are always the Greeks. You know why? Because they wrote a lot of stuff down. The Persians were terrible at this part. So we all love the Greeks. I'm going to pick on Les Booth here in a little bit, because he gave a message a few weeks ago on Esther, and he made a comment of King Xerxes, who we'll cover during this, you know, and he's like, "You remember those really bad guys who fought at the Battle of 300 and, you know, came in with the Greeks?" We always think of the Greeks or the Persians as the bad guys because the story is told by the Greeks. Herodotus, this great storyteller of the ancient world, gives us a story. I'm here to tell you, folks, the Greeks aren't usually the good guys. We like their government that we've kind of adopted, and the Western culture has used the Greco-Roman world, but read the Bible, the Greeks aren't the good guys. Look what they did to the people of God in Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes comes in and desecrates the temple, and how the Maccabees in the intertestamental period are going. They're not the good guys. There's only one empire in the ancient world that is spoken of never in a negative light. And it's the guys we typically think, who we poorly understand, are often looked back as the bad guys. So they're the ones in the modern world, we look at them that way too, because it's modern day Iran, and they're not usually the good guys either, are they? Never. At least in the past 100 years. And so in the modern world, they're the antagonist to the Jewish people, which we usually support. But in this ancient world, these are the people who, as we're going to see, represent this coming millennial period, and they make it happen in a way. And so I'd like to really kind of to understand that king who allowed that to happen better. And I think it'd be good to understand that empire better so we can really see what that's like. So this is a multi-part message. Today what I'd like to do is mainly look at who are the Persians, who is Cyrus specifically who creates this empire and the world there exists. So we'll use some biblical messages to go from Cyrus down through King Artaxerxes, so the first five rulers of the Persian Empire. And my goal is to show you who they were, really more anything, what that world that existed. And we're going to use Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther and some of the scriptures where they kind of interact with the people of God. But if we can understand this world a little bit better, then I'm going to have two follow-up messages as well, where we're going to look at the three minor prophets for this period. So Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi, who come on the scene then, and I love the stories of the minor prophets, but I think if we look at their messages, really understanding this world a little better, and what it was, and if we understand the world that was created, that Cyrus and then his progeny do, I think it gives us a little bit better light in really understanding the millennium better, and God's plan better, and the message that those three prophets bring. But today we're going to set that stage, and I'll take my time really kind of setting that up of understanding who Cyrus is, and then understanding who the Persian Empire are, and how their interactions with the people of God are always basically a positive, and how they literally, they changed the world at this time in the ancient way. So that's our setup. So who is Cyrus? So 100 years before he even comes on the scene, before he is even born, we know that this man exists. Let's start in Isaiah 44 that really sets it up. So Isaiah 44, one of only two instances where God names a ruler before they're born. Isaiah 44, in verse 28, God's talking about what will happen in the future. And he says, "Who says of Cyrus that he is my shepherd?" That word literally means Messiah. "And he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, 'You shall be built,' and to the temple, 'Your foundation shall be laid.'" Verse 45, or chapter 45, 1 says, "Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held to subdue the nations before him. To loose the armor of the kings, to open the door to him, to double doors, to the gates that will be shut." Speaking of the kingdom of Babylon, "I will go before you and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of bronze and cut the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness and the hidden riches of secret places, that you may know that I am the Lord who call on you by name and am the God of Israel." So God sets up by saying, this is my shepherd who will come on the scene. This will be my Messiah. This will be my individual who will free my people and loose the bonds. He is my anointed whose right hand I will hold up. Those are pretty strong words said about a Gentile ruler who has yet to be born. That's not very common of something we read about in the Old or the New Testament, but he is holding this person up in a fairly high regard of what will be coming and why I'm bringing him and what he will do for my people. So Cyrus is described in a strong way, and coming onto exist, who will come onto the scene, and this description literally calling him that Messiah, that person who will be the one to deliver my people, to destroy the kingdoms, and to set up a kingdom that I am prescribing that will be to rebuild a new Jerusalem. That's the verbiage he's using here about this man. So Cyrus, the Messiah, is going to deliver God's people. He's going to remove the bonds of the kingdom of men. He's going to return the people to the land that they were promised, and will institute the building and rebuilding of a new Jerusalem. The overlay from a prophetic sense and from a, so, you know, think of what Moses did coming to deliver God's people from bondage, to take them back to Jerusalem and rebuild, to what this man is being told will do and will. to what Christ does in the future. You know, you have basically three deliverers in the Old Testament to God's people when they're in bondage. But one of them is a Gentile king, which I've always found to be a fact. God can raise anybody. That's the important part. God does the delivering. But he can use anybody. In this case, he will use a Gentile to fulfill the Moses role from the Old Testament. We're kind of looking at a parallel story from the spring holy day story that we look at to what is really a fall holy day story, that he becomes the Moses character in this scenario. So these comparisons are really strong. So we have that this is the guy who's going to do it. And we have here, this is a map of, by the time he's done, this is all the lands that he will conquer. And at this point, when he dies, he will be the greatest conqueror in the ancient world and will not be surpassed until Alexander the Great comes onto the scene. So who is he? So he's a deliverer. He's a Messiah-like character. He's the greatest conqueror in the ancient world. Who is Cyrus the Great of Persia? So we all know the ancient world a little bit here as, you know, the Fertile Crescent is the world we look at the most. You know, modern-day Iraq, the Tigris and the Euphrates, you know, Babylon, Assyria, just kind of to the north and east of it. We see modern-day Turkey and then lots of lands off to the right there. This was the world that existed at the time. And the center of it that we always view is really kind of that Mesopotamia area, then obviously to the east a little bit where Jerusalem was. That was the center of the world and everything created. And Assyria, who was the great empire that leads up to this, you know, Babylon comes on the scene a little bit and obviously conquers Jerusalem, but Assyria really was the world-creating empire of this era. And as we all know, they were cruel and they were terrible. And they flattened the world of any that came before them, and they destroyed with utter destruction any that came in their way. We know what they did to the northern kingdom of Israel and took them away and sent their ashes to the universe in a way that they won't be seen again until the future. And they did that to a lot of people. And they ruled with fear. And everybody in the world, you either feared them if you lived under their rule, or you feared that one day you might. And that was the world that was created for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that's how everybody ruled. That was the ancient world this time. That was how you kept the peace. Because everybody, you know, of all the places, Assyria discovered we can just be cruel and be meaner than everybody else, and that's how we will keep order. But by 615, some groups of people began to not like that. And so if we have here our kind of area that would have been that, we have up through here where Media and Parthia and down to Parsa, these are the Zagros Mountains that separate this area from what we would now call the Hindu Kush, what would have been now Pakistan and India. But these Zagros Mountains were areas where nomadic people roamed in small bands, and they also lived under, as everybody did, the Assyrian rule. But a group here in Media, kind of the area there, number two, kind of started to coalesce under a great ruler named Cyaxares, and as he kind of gathered his people together, and they decided to rebel. And within a three-year period, which is astounding because of how long Assyria ruled, this king of Media conquered and destroyed Nineveh, the great city of Assyria, and destroyed the Assyrian Empire in a way that most people never thought could have been the case. Turn with me to Nahum 3. You know, God tells that will be the case. God set up Assyria and using them as a power to bring, you know, judgment on his people, but he said they won't stay around. And Nahum 3 takes a little bit to find Nahum, I understand. It's not one you just kind of flip to on a normal Wednesday. You know, just feeling like reading Nahum today. But Nahum is a scripture against Nineveh. And Nahum 3 verse 1 says, "Woe to the bloody city," speaking of the city of Nineveh. There he's portraying what will happen to this terrible people. "It is full of lies and robbery. Its victims never departs. The noise of a whip and the noise of rattling wheels." The Assyrians were known for their chariots. That was what their weapon of choice that they really conquered the world with. "And the noise of galloping horses and of clattering chariots and horsemen charged with bright sword and glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain, a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses." So speaking of what this city and the utter destruction that was resulted upon it, that was done by these people, the Medes of Media, this tribal nomadic people that coalesced to basically become a people. And their next king after Cyaxares, fun names, if you can write it down and get it spelled right, you're better than me. So his son Astyages was the next king, and so now Media had kind of taken over as the great power. I mean, Assyria had ruled forever and a power vacuum existed. And now Media became this great people, and he sees everybody else has these great big cities, and these were nomadic folk. And so he decides to build a great city. It was called Ecbatana, which is up there by number two, the capital of the Median Empire. And he builds these big cities, but remember, these are nomadic people, and they start to kind of chafe at the idea of living in cities. And Astyages followed suit. You know, everybody else ruled with an iron fist. I'll do the same. And he was a cruel individual as well. And so all these people kind of living in cities all of a sudden, it wasn't very happy. And Astyages was, like many people, you know, a spiritual, quote-unquote, people in the ancient world, began to have dreams. And the interpretations by his magi said that the dreams are that his daughter's child will be the one that will depose him. And he was scared of those dreams. So he has his wife sent off to a backwards area of these small group of people down in the bottom here in a land called Parsa, which ends up becoming the Persians. And he marries her off to this backwater individual in the royal family down there, thinking, I'll just get her away. That way it won't happen. And so she goes down there, marries one of these quote-unquote Persians, these people that would coalesce in the future. But he keeps having these dreams. And I won't go into detail because they're pretty graphic dreams. But he keeps having them, and so he realizes something, you know, something else is more. And then she has her son, and he keeps having them, and he realizes he should get rid of him. So he orders that the son be killed, but his usually is a twist of fate, and most of time, somebody grabs him and takes him off to be raised by a shepherd out in the fields. Sounds a lot like Moses' story, doesn't it? And Jesus' story, if you kind of see him a bit. And so Cyrus is born to this man's daughter, but he makes his way back and eventually becomes the king of these backwards people called the Parsians, or the Persians is what they become. And Astyages realizes that this is the case, so he recognizes, I need to make sure this doesn't happen, so he invades this large force, now the new great empire on the scene, the Medes. And he goes to try to conquer these Persians, but as is the case, he does not succeed. And Cyrus leads this small band of nomadic people and defeats the great empire of the Medes over a few years of battle. But this is where the story changes. Because instead of being like all his predecessors and marching in after having defeated this Astyages, his grandfather, he doesn't take his head and cut it off and put it on a pike and, you know, have fires around and eat dinner with his wife, like Ashurbanipal, the last ruler of the Assyrians, did to the people of Elam, or all these other people have done. What he does is he pardons him. And he sends him off into retirement. A very cushy one with that. Now, he's not a ruler anymore, but he then walks into the city Ecbatana as a hero. And the Medians, the people, the ruling families otherwise realize they've not been very happy, and he treats them with respect. He rebuilds their city. He comes in and shows grace and mercy. And you have to understand, that might not sound like a big deal, but in this world, that was huge. This was somebody new. He was changing the way the world worked, and the people received it quite well. Now, once this happens, like I said, when you start getting power vacuums, other people are going to recognize that. And so up in what would be modern-day Turkey, it was a group of people called the Lydians, whose capital was the city of Sardis. The Lydians, quite rich, their king was named Croesus. Croesus, you know, rich as Croesus is a phrase that still comes down to this day. One of the largest gold-producing areas in the ancient world. They had plenty of money, and they thought very highly of themselves. So he decides to march his armies down and figure, I'm going to take advantage of the Medians just falling, and I'm going to try to take them out as well. And so he comes marching down, and Cyrus, you know, knowing this is the case, has now joined the Medes and the Persians, starts marching his armies out as well. And they actually march right past Nineveh in its destroyed case on the way to battle. And the battle goes for a long time, and it kind of comes down to a stalemate. And what was kind of the theme of the world at that time is it becomes winter. And usually armies would separate during winter and go back to their homes. And like, oh, we'll come back in the spring and we'll pick this up, but I remember what you did. So you go home, I'll go home, and we'll pick it up in April. But Cyrus doesn't. So as Croesus turns and starts marching back to Sardis, Cyrus just keeps following him at a distance so he doesn't know. Croesus gets back up to Lydia, sends all of his armies home, sends all of his people back to their lands, and he goes up to his great capital, which there in Sardis. So this is pictures I took when I was there this summer. Sardis was known as one of the great capitals. This was their Acropolis. So the land is kind of a plain around it. But right in the middle, on top of that mountain, it's a southern view on the left and an eastern view on the right of this Acropolis, had never fallen. He felt safe there. And now all of a sudden, Cyrus shows up unexpectedly, and he doesn't have his army. But he still feels safe because nobody has ever breached these walls of this great. Look at that. You can't just climb that up with an army. It's not going to happen. So he feels he'll be fine. I'll hold it out till my army can come back in the spring. We read about, there's an allusion to this battle. Go to Revelation 3, the only time we see Sardis in the Bible, but there's an allusion to it. When Christ sends this message to this church, He alludes to what happens in this scene. Revelation 3, because Cyrus knows he can't march an army right up on top of that Acropolis and take it, but he sends his men around, and some of the men start to see that there's a lot of birds congregating up on the top in one of these areas. And they reason to themselves, if there's birds congregating there, that means there's not people. Because if there are people there, the birds wouldn't stay. And they find a back way in. They climb. Yes, an army can't take this, but a few men can. And they climb up, they sneak in, they open the gates, and Cyrus walks in and destroys and takes over this area. In Revelation 3:3, Christ says to these people in Sardis generations later, "Remember therefore how you have received and heard, hold fast and repent. Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief, and you will not know what hour I come upon you." Because these people here and all through history thought they were safe in this Acropolis so much that nobody could take them, until this man did. Generations later, they would fall back in and think, oh, they're still safe. And Alexander the Great, when he would come in, would do the exact same thing. Twice in their history, the only times the city would ever fall was not due to an army. It was due to a few men acting as a thief in the night. So when Christ says this to these people, he was using an allusion of something those people would have understood. It's like, hey, you remember, you might think you're great, which is what he says to this church, but you can fall just as easily. As a thief in the night, I will come, and you know what that means. So there's an allusion here to how Cyrus takes this city. This is the great capital of the Lydian Empire. And so now Cyrus, once again, treats these people very similarly. Croesus is not deposed. Croesus stays in power. In fact, he joins Cyrus's retinue in his court and would be by his side until the day Cyrus dies in battle many, many years later. And the people are left alone. They pay tribute. They would become part of the Persian Empire, but they're treated with respect. And like I said, Croesus is not killed and his body burned and the people to look upon and made an example of, but he joins his army and is a general of his until the end. His best general was a former Median general. He takes in a lot of these individuals to become part of his people. He treats them differently. Mercy and grace is granted to all these people. That themes I talked about is what God was building with his people is how this man kind of brings in as well. So now after this moment, Cyrus kind of, if we go back to our map, so he's taken over the central area. He's taken over what is modern-day Turkey. He goes next over the Zagros Mountains into the Hindu Kush, that whole huge area to the right. We don't know anything about it. He doesn't take very good records, and neither do the people of that area, but he spends a large amount of time conquering a huge amount of space. But when he comes back from that, what he has left is the crown jewel. He's taken everything around it except Babylon. And so now it's time to look at the great city, Babylon, this greatest city that existed in the ancient world, and he moves to go towards that. And on the way, he used a lot of propaganda telling the people that he was going to come in as a righteous ruler. But the weird thing is, he followed through. Is it propaganda if you do it? That's a good question. But propaganda usually is thought of as a negative, but he would send forwards like, hey, you know, and so on his march towards there, whole nations and whole cities would open their gates to him and let him come in, and he'd treat them well. Generations later, the Greek historian Xenophon, so remember, the Greeks are the mortal enemies of the Persians. They hate them. And Xenophon, a Greek warrior historian later, would later write in speaking backwards about Cyrus. He said that he eclipsed all monarchs either before him or since. No matter whom he conquered, he would inspire in them a deep longing to please him and to bask in his good opinion. They found themselves longing to be guided by his rulings, his and no one else's. That's what his enemy said about him. And so when he comes down to Babylon, this great city with the great walls, he conquers it as well. And he takes over the Fertile Crescent, the great city that had enslaved God's people. That's the king who did all this over decades, who shows up when we read Ezra 1. So let's now start the story of who this man who walks in and takes over this great city and finds himself now ruling over the people of God, in addition to many others. Because no conqueror before him had ever shown such clemency or such restraint. And his reward was an empire, as I said, that had never been rivaled. This is the greatest, largest empire that would exist until Alexander the Great comes on the scene. And while some of his descendants would make it a little bit larger here and there, he primarily does about 85 to 90% of the size of this empire. And so we have now in Ezra 1, here's kind of a timeline now as we see kind of the beginning. In 538, that's when Cyrus takes over Babylon, and he comes in and he fulfills what God said right in the beginning. It says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, and the Lord stirred up the spirit in Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all the kingdom and put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord of God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem, and whoever is left in any place where he dwells, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, besides the freewill offerings of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And the heads of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites with all their spirits of God removed and arose and went to build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. That's Yul Brynner saying, yeah, you should go, and let me pay for it. And anybody who goes against you, I will take care of. You go with my name, do it. Use my materials, use my money, use my people, use my roads, go home and rebuild Jerusalem. And this scripture right here that has been found in portions of it has been found in actual archaeological findings since then. The Cyrus cylinder is kind of famous. It's in the museum in London that speaks of this kind of moment here. This happened. And it happened through God. I'm not trying to take away who, you know, obviously this is God raised this individual, but this is a Gentile ruler who acted in the complete opposite of Pharaoh. And so when I read that story of the original Passover in Egypt, I like to think, what would it have been like? But here's what it was like. For these people for 70 years were subjugated and ruled and enslaved. And this man comes in and fulfills his propaganda and fulfills what God had said of him and says, go home. Not only that, it's on me. I've got it all taken care of. You don't own, all you've got to do is walk. That's Cyrus the Great. That's this Gentile ruler who reconstitutes the world. Not just the people here in Jerusalem and sending the Israelites home. He changed the world. He took a world ruled by fear, a world ruled by despots, of people who were afraid and he took it. And it was still, you know, there's still bad people in the world. I'm not trying to say that all of a sudden, but he took a world and changed it. As we look forward in the future, what this post-exilic period looks at in our history, what will happen after that tribulation when God will come, the true Messiah, the great Messiah in Christ, will all of a sudden institute a generation of 1,000 years where justice and grace and mercy is what rules the day. So grace and mercy is what gets us here. But what he created in this timeline, so we have in the blue are all the empire, or the kings of Persia from Cyrus through Artaxerxes. Underneath it there in the red, we have obviously the Jewish leaders who will go, and in the yellow are when we see in this timeline, when will be the moments that these prophets come online. But throughout this entire time frame here, 538 to 424 here, justice will be the theme we see. Grace and mercy got them here to change the world and recreate who this is. And as we're going to see here, the theme we walk through from the rest of this on is what will, whenever anything happens, justice will be served in a way that we never see in the Old Testament otherwise from Gentile cultures. So Cyrus will soon die after this. He will kind of continue on, go fighting. He goes up north and falls to a very interesting story that I won't get into, to a female ruler of a steppe people. He's succeeded by his son Cambyses, who is not in the Bible, who rules very briefly. There's a lot of conflicting reports. He spends most of his time down in Egypt. He eventually falls. There is a power struggle that exists afterwards, and Darius comes into rule. Darius is not related to Cyrus. He was one of his generals, and a usurper tries to get on the throne after his son Cambyses dies. Darius kills the usurper. There's a lot of kind of back and forth of what really happened, but Darius is his general. Now, he'll marry Cyrus's daughter to kind of keep the line going. So it's kind of like a Ford, you know, if you're of the Ford family and you keep passing your generations down, you're kind of the guy who married into it. So Darius is not a relative. He just marries into the family, but rules for a long period of time. Darius comes on the scene. He expands the empire a little bit, kind of up into Europe. He goes into Greece for a little bit. Darius is called the shopkeeper. And at first you might think of this great empire. That doesn't sound like a great ruler, the shopkeeper. But you have to understand he rules more like a CEO. But he's the CEO of the largest, most powerful organization ever. It's like Apple and Walmart combined. He's like Tim Cook meets the Walton family. So he rules in a way that really is more administratively. He organizes the empire into regions. He puts satraps and governors and over the regions. So he organizes in a way that kind of creates a good government. He creates the derrick, named after himself, which is a coinage. And that coin can be used throughout that empire, anywhere you go. We take this for granted now, but this is a big deal back then. Not only could you use in the empire, you could use the derrick outside of the empire because they were so strong and powerful, people would use that currency. I was in Jamaica last month. I used dollars when I was down there because of the power of the American dollar. That's what he kind of starts creating, this royal coinage that allows that. He built numerous roads, a postal system. He increases naval shipping. He standardizes weights and measures. It doesn't sound very weird, but you realize you have a pound of gold and you travel a couple days journey and they say, nope, you've got 3 ounces because everybody uses their own weights. I have this rock and I call that a pound, but you have that rock. He standardizes throughout the whole thing how you weigh things. Once again, a simple little thing, but this is the shopkeeper. This is a man who's really more an organizational CEO of an empire that spans the globe of the modern day world that they live in. Now, he would also invade Greece because the Greeks revolted. So as everyone likes to make the Persians wrong, they don't go in there just for fun. The Greeks try to revolt, and so Darius leads an army in and tries to quell it. They lose at the Battle of Marathon, which is a famous one. It gave us the race that is a terrible thing to this day, and it's named after it, but it comes from that battle. But Ezra 4 starts to tell us now the story of Darius. He comes on the scene and is involved with God's people. Ezra 4:24 tells us that the work on the temple stops. These people went home, but they gave up. And I'm not going to go into that whole story. Ezra 5:1 brings Haggai and Zechariah on the scene. We can see where we are here from the time frame on the side there. And they come on and try to get everybody and prompt them to get started. But interference comes from the locals. Those people who had been moved back into that area over those 70 years where the Jews were gone don't really like these people coming back. And as we know, they bring the lawyers in, always the worst thing. You can bring armies all you want, but when you bring lawyers, now you're fighting dirty. And so we have on the case here in Ezra 5, verse 7 through 17, we have Tatnai, who is the ruler of the Samaritans of that area, and he sends a letter to Darius. Like I said, the lawyers come in, it's like, we're going to appeal to him. He won't allow this to happen. And so he sends a letter to Darius. This is, once again, back at the Louvre. Me on the left, my daughter on the right. The left here, this is the frieze that would have surrounded Darius's throne room in Susa, which was his capital. This is the room he would have received this letter in. So I remember walking through this when we went through the Louvre in Paris a few years ago. On the right, you have my little daughter Cameron there down in the bottom right. You can see, based on her size, she's a little taller now, so you have to go a little bit off. These bowls that hold up the ceiling, there were 33 of these. That's the cap. That is about this, of this. Big, large wooden structures that held up how this massive building, that was just the top of it. That they had 33 of these, right? It was this amazing room when you see, and this is where Tatnai's letter would have been received by this great king who's going over ledgers and creating, you know, coinage and weights and measures, and he gets this. And, you know, when you think about how would have an Assyrian reacted, how would have all these other kings reacted, and Darius we see in Ezra chapter 6, verse 1, we hear he's received this as Darius the king issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. So let's go back and look. What are they referring? Who are these people? He doesn't snap to judgment. And in Achaemenia, in the palace, that is the province of Media, this was the royal storage area, a scroll was found. And in it, and a record was discovered. In the first year of Cyrus, it says this is the roll they found. King of Cyrus issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem, let the house be rebuilt, the people where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations be firmly laid to a height of 60 cubits. And with three rows, and he goes through kind of all the different, you know, what is there to kind of go back and build. So he finds Cyrus's record of what he sent. In verse 6, he says, "Now therefore Tatnai, governor of the region of on the river, the lawyer who sent this letter, and to your companions," verse 7, "let the work of the house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build the house of God on the site. Moreover, I issue a decree as to what you shall do to the elders of the Jews and for the building of this house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from the taxes on the region beyond the river. This is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs, give them to them." Jumping over into verse 12, "And may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it, or to destroy this house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue a decree, let it be done diligently." You never see that response in anywhere else. Now, once again, I'm not saying that Darius is a godly man or is a member of the Church of God. The point that I'm making as I'm making through all this is whenever the people of God were in trouble in this time frame, they could allude to or ask for the greatest power in the world at the time, and justice was served. He didn't say, "Well, you're usurpers, share the land," or, "No, Tatnai's right." He says, no. Not only that, he makes Tatnai pay for it. Every time throughout this story, when the people of God need help and ask for it, the Persian Empire gives it. First in Cyrus, in this case now in from Darius. The future implication of the millennial period that we look forward to is of righteous justice will always be served. When we know that in the millennium, that it's not that everything will be hunky-dory all the time. Zechariah tells us of people who won't march up to the mountain. There will be times when justice needs to be served. And that's what we're seeing here. It will always, though, be done in a righteous way that supports God's people, and the right thing will be done. That's who the Persians are in this case. That's what they're providing. Xerxes is the next king after Darius. Xerxes gets a bad rap. I'm picking on a bit of less, because you even said in your message, I'm thinking in my head, that Xerxes is now the king. So when Darius, near his end, after that battle of Marathon, he goes home. He'd been defeated, so he starts to raise another army, and he's going to go back, but then he dies. And so Xerxes, his son, takes over, and he now has this army, and they're going to go put down this rebellion. Xerxes is the king who comes in, fights the Lacedaemonians, the people of Sparta at the Battle of Thermopylae, and we all love, because those 300 people, that sounds really neat, and then beats them, and then goes in, but eventually falls the Battle of Plataea and the Battle of Salamis, where the Greeks are overcome, and Herodotus writes these great stories of this evil King Xerxes and his horrible people who came in. Most modern historians actually view Xerxes as actually a pretty good guy, and like I said, the Greeks aren't the good guy. Xerxes is the king who is with Esther. And I won't go through it, so Les actually saved me some time because he did that message. But once again, when Mordecai needs help, when Esther needs help, now Xerxes had been fooled by Haman. So think about how much that takes to when the people of God, though, needed help, Xerxes overrules himself. Now he can't because of the law of the Medes and the Persians, so he finds a way to do it. But he basically acknowledges, "I'm wrong," and he helps them. Not only does he help them, let's go to Esther 10. We'll just read one quick scripture in there. Oh, I went too far. Just from the end, like I said, we know that story. Esther 10, verse 1 says, "And King Ahasuerus," so King Xerxes, "imposed tribute on the land and all the islands of the sea. And now all the acts of the power of his might and of the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to the which the king advanced him, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Xerxes, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of the brethren, seeking the good of his people and seeking peace to all his countrymen." Mordecai is in their annals as their second in command. He is written into their books. And Xerxes helps the people of God and saves them when he is brought this judgment before him. So while he gets a bad rap by the Greeks, if you're looking at history from the perspective of the people of God, the Greeks treated them poorly. Xerxes did not. Xerxes then is followed by his son Artaxerxes. Got a little bit boring with the names. He just added a little bit in front of him. Ezra, if we go back to Ezra chapter 7, we have Xerxes interacting with the people of God. Ezra 7, verse 8. It says, now Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. And on the first day of the first month, he began his journey from Babylon. On the first day of the fifth month, it came to Jerusalem according to the goodwill of God upon him. And Ezra had prepared for his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach the statutes and the ordinances of Israel. This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra, the priest, the scribe, expert in the words of his commandments of the Lord and his statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra, the priest, scribe of the law, peace, peace, and so forth. I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests of the Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up, and whereas you are being sent by the king and of his seven counselors to inquire concerning the people of Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of God, which is in your hand. And whereas you are to carry the silver and the gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, and whereas all the silver and gold that you may find in all the province of Babylon, along with the freewill offerings of the people and the priests, are freely offered to the house of God in worship. I'm sending you from me, and take all the money with you, and whatever money you find on Babylon on your way, take that too. So he's sending him along with all this, dropping down to verse 25. And you, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom, let the magistrates and judges who may judge you, all the people who are in the region beyond the river, all such as know the laws of God and teach those who do not know them. Whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily on him, whether it be death or banishment or confiscation of goods or imprisonment. Pretty good. Once again, go, take the money, and make sure people follow God. And if they don't, you can punish them in my name. Skipping over one page in chapter 8, verse 36, just kind of concludes, and it says, and they delivered the king's orders to the kings, to the satraps, and to the governors, all these people who usually opposed them, to the region beyond the river, so that they gave support to the people of God and to the house of God. So once again, the next king follows suit with the ones before him and gives them help. Nehemiah chapter 2, just to close up a little bit then. So Artaxerxes sends Ezra. He's also going to send Nehemiah. Nehemiah is Artaxerxes' cupbearer, which is a high honor that we read about in chapter 1 of Nehemiah. So he's serving in Artaxerxes' court. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1, it says, and I came to pass in the month of Nisan on the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine. He waited till he had a little wine before he asked. So I took that before him, and I took the wine and gave it to the king, and I had never been sad in his presence before. So Artaxerxes asked, why are you sad? Skipping down to verse 4. It says, then the king said to me, what do you request that I pray to the God of heaven? And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. That the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, And I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, and there must be given me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall and the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of the God upon me. And I went to the governors of the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. And the king had sent captains of the army and horses with me. Go. Here's an army to protect you. We all know about Nehemiah building the wall. It's this great moment in ancient, you know, Judah history. He does it because the king said, take my timber. I will pay for it. I will support it. Use my resources. Every time the people of God needed help. Further example, once again, of the people getting help whenever they needed it from this kingdom at the time. Four different rulers over 100 years support the people of God, and when justice was needed, provided it. That's the Persian Empire of this ancient world. Now, Artaxerxes is the last ruler that's mentioned in the Bible. They last on for a few more generations, but then the Greeks, they are finally defeated by the Greeks. Alexander the Great will be the one who finally, you know, takes them down. They'll come back in reincarnations through time. But this is the highlight of their empire. And it existed in a time where the Jews rebuilt and the people of God returned. And every time they needed help, they provided it. And we know in the future, every time we will need help, living in a physical world in that millennial time period, when people are raised up, justice will always be there. And grace and mercy will be mixed in a way to build the people up, but when something happens and they need it, there will be a physical ruler over that time period and a physical kingdom where justice will be served. So like I said, that's the background. So I'll end there. My hope is to do two more messages where we're going to look at the words of Zechariah and Haggai. We'll do them in tandem, and then the words of Malachi. But look at now, we understand a little bit of what this world is and the people that they're operating under, not just to the Jews, because obviously they're coming back and speaking to the Jews, but they're doing it in a world that's different that we see then throughout the entire Old Testament. So I wanted to set that up. And how does their message, it's still the same message, I'm not giving you any new truths, but can we understand their message a little bit better? And so when we read Zechariah, which is often done, you know, when we come down to the fall holy days, can we understand those messages a little bit better when they speak of the millennium and that future? Because they're seeing a glimpse of it in a distorted way, but now we understand a little bit more of that world, I think, that they live in. And I think maybe we can bring out a little bit more as we go through a study of the minor prophets with that. So I appreciate it very much, everybody. Now you can go eat snacks.